Okay, and welcome back. More and more people are noticing how Donald Trump is denying his own past statements. More and more, it's becoming glaringly obvious to almost any average observer that Donald Trump can't keep his story straight or doesn't want to keep his story straight. We have a crisis of leadership. For the first time today, I did see a story that, here's the headline. Will the U.S. reach 100,000 deaths after an horrific April? That grim milestone could hit us in the middle of May. And that's from USA Today. So I think even the mainstream media is getting to the point where they can't deny the fact that Trump's initial projections of 50 to 60,000 dead are not even close to being correct. And what we do each night here in our third hour with Dr. Henry Nyman is try to bring you up to date and give you a better view of the big picture of what's going on all around us and all around the world for that matter. Hello, Henry. Welcome back. So the 100,000 barrier has been mentioned for the first time that I've seen in the mainstream media.
Yeah, and the reason is because of what the real count is. And you know, as I said, it's going up 2,000 a day. And as you said, Trump's projection of 50 to 60,000 is history. And it actually got to 60,000 in April, the month that the virus was supposed to disappear. And it's still around. It's May. And the deaths are still going up at about 2,000 a day. It's a little bit under that today. But what was striking today was the number of new cases. There were over 34,000 new cases today alone.
And, wow. Is that a record?
And that was... And I think so. And the record I know is above 30, but I think 34 is probably the record or extremely close to the record. And well, there's two things that are notable about the 34,000. One is that the cases are declining in New York and New Jersey, which are the two states that have been creating the largest number of new cases as well as the largest number of deaths. And New York had gotten up to 10,000-11,000 cases a day. And today it was only 3,942. So it was under 4,000 today. And New Jersey kind of picked up the slack somewhat and was getting in the neighborhood of 3,500 a day. And today it was 2,500. So the two of them, only did 6,500 new cases. And in spite of that, lower than usual, even when New York went down, the two of them together were generally doing 10,000 cases. Today, they only did 6,500. And in spite of that low number from them, the total was 34,000. And it was because so many states now are reporting 500 or more cases per day. And I got in front of me just a quick rundown for today. This is today alone. Massachusetts had 2106. Pennsylvania had 1208. California had 1935. Michigan had 977. Illinois had 3,137. Florida had 1,038. Louisiana had 710. Connecticut had 1,064. Texas had 1,142. Georgia had 1,443. They opened up early. You know, they got 1,443 cases today alone. Maryland had 1,730. I mean, usually there'd be one or two or maybe three states other than New York and New Jersey that would do over 1,000 in a day. And I just went through the list, and almost every one of them was 1,000. Some were 2,000. Some were, one got up to 3,000. And it wasn't New York or New Jersey. So it's clear that either they're doing more testing or they've discovered that there are all of these cases in captive populations like nursing homes or jails or unfortunately these processing plants, and they're actually going in and getting pressure to do more testing in those facilities because they're overloaded with asymptomatic cases, which in some instances are pre-symptomatic cases. And so waiting around for them to develop symptoms is not necessarily a good idea because they can infect others before they are symptomatic. So by the time they develop symptoms, they've already infected X number of people in the facility. And there are large numbers that are being cited, in one prison in a state, and then they've got 20 other prisons that they've never tested anybody. And so I'm not sure where all of these cases are coming from, but from the list I gave you, you can see it's not one or two states. It's really,
no, it's up in headlines right now. You can see all this that Henry's mentioning. It's right there. You'll see it. 900 workers at the Tyson meat plant in Indiana test positive. Tyson says it will not shut down its Waterloo plant. They're just saying no to Trump. And we have reports that a couple of other plants apparently have reopened under Trump's mandate.
Yeah, but they're going to run out of workers because basically, A, they can't work if they're sick. B, they're saying, well, if you don't come, we're going to cut off your unemployment benefits. If the job's available, you got to come. But I would think that sooner or later they're going to get OSHA involved. I mean, they can't force workers to work under unsafe conditions. And if they've got a potentially fatal disease that's going around at the plant, and in some cases where they're refusing to let them know what the status of that plant is with regard to other workers because they won't test them. They test the supervisors and find too many positives to test the rank and file because they'll have hundreds of positives.
Right. Now, here's the other story. Trump was talking about, and I guess, I don't know if he's done it yet, I don't think he has, or we'd have known about it, of absolving all corporations and companies of liability. So they can't be sued by OSHA or anybody on an independent civil basis. They can't. Yeah. The companies are held harmless.
Well, OSHA's a government agency, so
yes.
I don't know that they would be protected from violating government.
I don't know how that works, but the whole government thing.
I think that would probably be private individuals are going to be prohibited from suing them. But I would think OSHA's mission is to make us a safe work environment. I mean, that's what they do.
Well, how does that link up with Trump's order that they all go back to work? It doesn't make any sense. It's more craziness.
They've got to go back to a safe environment. It's basically they've started putting up plexiglass and trying to do fever checks and require everybody to wear a mask. So they're taking these measures, but the argument on the mask is, you're protecting other people, but it just doesn't project as far. And they're pretty close together, all these plants. I used to do this in the Chicago Stockyards. I was in the Amalgamated Meat Cutters and Butcher Workmen of North America, Local 100. And and we had, you mentioned this Waterloo plant, and it's owned by Tyson. But Tyson bought IBP, which is Iowa Beef Packers. And Iowa Beef Packers used to be the largest beef packer in the United States. And we dealt with with IBP back when I was in the stockyards in the in the 1970s. I think it was, let's see, no, 1969. There was a a strike. There was a dispute between IBP and the union, and the union went on strike, and then they took the meat from Iowa and shipped it to Chicago to get it processed. And we were processing IBP's meat, and the union came and said, "Well, we want you to refuse to accept this meat." And the thing that was so bizarre about that whole situation, the plant I was at worked on piecework. So basically, you got paid by the piece. The unions didn't like it because the workers would make like double union wage because they would work extremely
real fast.
Quickly. You're right.
Yes.
And the stuff that was coming from IBP was twice as big as anything that we would normally get. So working on IBP was essentially cutting our wage in half. I mean, we were working twice as fast as union scale, but we were making union scale because it took twice as long to do each piece. And we had already complained to the union that we shouldn't be getting the same for a piece that was twice as large, you know, it shouldn't be at the same rate. And they're, "Oh, we can't do anything about that." And it turns out the same company is coming in and say, well, we can't do about anything about that either. So in any event, but there were issues with IBP in Chicago from work standards and issues. And in any event, I'm not surprised that a former IBP plant is having worker relations problems with unsafe conditions, or, you know, they basically ignored things until it got totally out of control.
You raise a very good point, though. How is OSHA going to perform its job and interface with Trump's executive order? That's going to be tricky tightrope walking.
I think that Trump is saying that they can't voluntarily close down, but he can't order them to work under unsafe conditions either. So I would think that OSHA would win out if it basically got to that. I mean, it sounds like they're trying to work things out voluntarily, and the town wants the plant to stay open because it provides most of the jobs, but they basically want it to be under better conditions. And there are some adjustments at some of the plants, and I think that, you know, they'll end up coming around because, but they may run out of workers. I mean, they already employ a high percentage of the people in the town.
Yes,
And it's not just the workers at the plants that they're infecting family members, that are infecting people at other plants. So there's some long-term care facilities in the same town that are now have infections because spouses brought the virus into those facilities. And there's other businesses in the towns that are getting infected. And it turns out in Iowa, they've got the Italian strain of the virus. I was going to talk about that today too. I'll just mention that right now a paper came out yesterday, last night, and it's a pre-paper. So, you know, these are papers that haven't gone through peer review yet, but they've been pushing to get them out quickly if they're on SARS. And this paper was. It was done by a group out of Los Alamos National Labs, as well as Duke University, and then a clinical group in England. And they were basically looking at sequences and noted that the Italian lineage was taking over the world, essentially. You know, they basically mm-hmm. said that it's rapidly expanding and is rapidly replacing the existing lineages. And that's kind of what I've been saying for the past month or so. And they gave a little bit of detail as to what they thought the mechanism was. And one thing that they noted in England, because that's where they had the clinical group, was that the patients that had the Italian lineage and had this change in the spike gene protein basically had a higher viral load based upon the PCR results from their samples that are basically indicated that there was a lot of viral RNA there. And, I've mentioned viral RNA load as being an important factor with regard to how, you know, infectious the person's going to be, as well as how severe the infection is going to be. And so they've got evidence that that the Italian strain does produce a higher viral load. And then, the mechanism of that is, they raised another issue, which was another one of these concerning factors that has been described for coronaviruses, and that is that the location of this mutation is in a kind of immunodominant region where it's in antibodies will bind to that to kind of attack the virus. But it's also in an area that's been involved with antibody-dependent enhancement, which I had mentioned a couple of weeks ago about the antibody actually facilitates the virus entry into the cells, and that they had seen that with dengue, where they had
that's really strange that would happen. An antibody facilitating entry. That just doesn't,
Right. It's called antibody, ADE, antibody-dependent enhancement. You can Google it. And so in any event, there's concern that the Italian strain may be growing at a quicker rate, producing a higher viral load. In part
growing, Henry.
Question:
growing, or is it also potentially mutating in some very minor fashion, which makes it more virulent? I mean, are we seeing that?
Well, it does have a mutation. It does have a mutation in the spike gene. It's got position 614. The D has changed to G, and that's why some call it the G clade is because it normally has a D at which is an aspartic acid, and the G is a glycine. It changes it to a glycine, and the change is could be doing all of these things. It could be modulating the immune response, and it could be leading to antibody-induced enhancement. So it is a mutation, and that is part of the definition of this Italian lineage. There are like four different positions that have changed, and this one is in the, this is the only one that's in the spike gene, which is makes the S gene, which makes the spike protein that gets the virus into the cell. It's like the H and influenza. This is the S gene. And it's also near the cleavage site, where the polybasic cleavage site is. So it's got some interesting features. And so on the one hand, that's the nitty gritty on exactly how it might be doing this. And on the other hand, what is clearly happening is it is becoming the dominant strain circulating worldwide. It's in Russia, and it's not just in the European portion of Russia. It's in Siberia. It's all over Russia, and originated in Italy, and it jumped all over the place. It jumped into sub-Sahara Africa. It went to Nigeria. It went to Algeria and north, north of the Sahara. And then it went to Brazil, and it has taken over South America. It's taken over Africa. It's taken over Europe. And it's heading towards taking over the United States. It's all along the East Coast. It's in New York, in New Jersey, in Pennsylvania, in Connecticut, and Massachusetts. And then recent sequences came out. It's in Maryland. It's in Rhode Island. And then it's also starting to make headway into the Midwest. So it's in Iowa. And then out west, it's in Phoenix, and it's starting to move into the Seattle area. And so in the more recent sequences out of Seattle, it's in over half of them. So you can see the effect of the virus. So the virus goes into areas where there's already another lineage circulating, and it basically starts to replace it. And in other areas, it's almost fully replaced it, like the Northeast in the U.S., where the highest cases are, and the highest number of cases, although, like I said, it's slowing down a little bit.
Survival of the deadliest.
New York and New Jersey. Yeah, well, it really comes down to it. If it can, it's the deadliest is a byproduct. It's not, its goal is to make a lot of product quickly, and that's what a higher viral load would indicate. It indicates that it may very well be able to more efficiently get into more cell types because there may be some antibody dependent enhancement. So it can more easily get into different cell types. Right. And in any event, there seems to be more of it in these cases, and it seems to be able to be more fit to basically take over a region, that it just does a better job of finding hosts and growing to high levels than the other lineages that are out there. And like I say, it's kind of moving all over, and then it kind of builds on that. I mean, once it's done this and you got this basic set of mutations, then it tacks on new ones, and they can recombine and pick up other ones. And this paper talks a little bit about recombination also, and they noticed that in some of the other mutations in the spike gene. So, in any event, that paper came out last night, and more people, I think, are probably going to start taking notice of this. It's really pretty obvious. If you're looking at these sequences, you see this Italian lineage show up again and again. And even in a place like Seattle, where it was dominated by that ORF8 mutation, right. that lineage. And that's all that was there initially. So, I mean, that's where the first case was in the United States, and then the community transmission ended up being the same lineage there. And then they did a lot of sequencing, and it just one right after the other was the same ORF8 lineage. And then recently, probably the beginning of April or so, it started to get the Italian lineage. And then by the end of April or mid-April, it became the more dominant one. It wasn't quite as dramatic as it is on the East Coast, but there was more of the Italian than there was of the ORF8 in the more recent sequences. And so that's definitely another one of the concerns, is that this particular lineage so, is going all over the place that it might have some this antibody enhancement.
Okay. To sum it up, the Italian strain appears to be becoming more virulent. Yes? Just to keep that straight.
Yeah, yeah. Because it almost has to be to take over these regions. I mean, A, mm-hmm. it's battling the host, but mm-hmm. B, is battling the other viruses. I mean, the mm-hmm. other SARS-CoV-2 viruses. And so if one is circulating in an area, and all of a sudden there's another one that's starting to replace it, then the one that's replacing it has got some type of selective advantage and is able to more effectively find new victims and cause problems than the prior version. So yeah, it is becoming more virulent, and it is growing to a higher level. I mean, I think they tried to look and see if it was a higher hospitalization, and they didn't get the statistical significance, but the higher CT value for the hybridization of the PCR reaction, how many times they have to amplify it to get a positive result, showed that the less you have to amplify it, that means the more that was there originally. And that those values are called CT values. The CT value indicated that there's more virus present in those patients. So that's one measure of virulence, just how quickly you can make a lot of virus. So that has been identified. And then, so speaking of the virus, the other development that I haven't gotten to the last couple of days, because I started talking about how many new cases there were, is some positive results that were with the remdesivir. And that's an antiviral that was tried out initially against Ebola. It didn't really perform that well relative to some of the other treatments. Mm-hmm. But it generally works on the polymerase encoded by the virus. It is actually an analog of one of the nucleotides that normally goes into the RNA, or goes into DNA too. But in this case, it is done by the virus's RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. So it basically uses the RNA in the virus as a template, and it copies that into a double strand of RNA, and that's how it basically reproduces. That's how it gets its genes copied over and over and over. And remdesivir is an analog of the adenosine, which is one of the four letters that goes in there, CA. And this one is modified so that when it goes into the RNA, it basically terminates the extension of it. So the virus starts copying its RNA, and it gets to remdesivir, and it sticks that one in, and then it can't extend that chain, and therefore it can't really copy its genetic information. And once it runs into that, it really can't grow. And that's kind of the mechanism. It basically targets the virus itself. And depending upon how much damage the virus has already done and what it's doing to the immune system and how that's reacting, this particular drug goes after the virus. And it's still controllable. then you end up getting a beneficial effect. And so what it showed in the trial, which was a placebo double blind, so that half or, sometimes you write it up one-third, two-thirds. But anyway... Mm-hmm. One part of the patients, it gets a placebo. Another portion, either a half or two-thirds, gets the drug. It's double-blind, so the patient doesn't know which one they got, and the doctors don't know which one they got. And then after X number of patients has been treated, then they go and they break the code and see who got what, and then compare the two groups and see if there's a difference. And the endpoint they were looking at in this case was days to release. Without the drug, people got discharged after 15 days on average. With the drug, it was 11 days. So they cut the hospitalization time by 4 days. It's somewhat similar to how Tamiflu works with influenza,
right.
that they usually want you to take it within 48 hours. And that the original clinical trial to show its effectiveness was the ability to have symptoms go away, how many days it took to suppress the symptoms. And that was the same thing. It generally did about 2 days quicker with Tamiflu, as long as it was taken within the first 48 hours. So this is the same thing, although this test was really for severe cases. So the cases that they tried it on were hospitalized cases, and I don't know the full set of criteria. I think they might have even had pneumonia already, and I'm pretty sure they actually had pneumonia already because they were in the hospital. And you know, these patients still took 15 days before they were discharged without the drug, and 11 days with the drug. One of the drawbacks is it doesn't cost that much to make, but it's a complex set of procedures to actually make the drug. And so they had originally, I think, 5,000 courses or so, and now they're upping that to like 100,000. And they're mostly looking to use it to kind of extend their results. And so, you know, they're not going to be charging anything for it initially. They're just going to be giving away for patients. And the reason Tony Fauci was so excited about it was that it reminded him of the early days for HIV treatment. And this was back when there really wasn't any treatment in almost all the cases.
Well, they were using AZT then, as you know, AZT, which was a failed cancer chemotherapy drug. They took it off the shelf.
Correct.
It had been around.
Correct. And so that was the initial positives they got with HIV. They started with AZT. They saw a small effect. And that was really the beginning, because that was a protease inhibitor. And what they found was if they used AZT, they could get some effect, but they would typically develop resistance to it, and then the patient would improve for a little bit and then kind of fade away. And then they ended up developing more protease inhibitors, and that if they kind of expanded that to combination therapy where they were using multiple drugs simultaneously, then they could knock out the virus quicker than it could mutate to get away from all of the drugs. They could get away from one or two of them, but not all of them. And that's, you know, the therapy, you know, the standard therapy today, and the vast majority of cases, or maybe even all the cases, you end up responding to that and can lead relatively normal lives as long as they keep taking their medication in most cases. So that was the beginning. It's what they saw with AZT, and that was a small effect, and AZT alone wasn't successful, but it kind of started the ball rolling, and they're kind of looking at remdesivir as an initial drug that definitely has an effect. They don't know for sure where the best effect would be, you know, whether it's going to work well if they start treating patients a little bit earlier when there's not quite as much virus, and then they might be able to knock the virus out before all these immunons are inflammation.
Well, it also would
host responses kick in.
Would it not? It would also pertain to what particular area of the body the cleavage issue If it's going after the neurological aspect of the brain, or if it's going after the kidneys or the liver, wouldn't that have something to do with the prescribed use of remdesivir?
No, not really, because it's a little molecule. So basically, and they give it by IV. So it could go anywhere the virus is, and it goes directly after the virus. So the location wouldn't be an indicator. It's the same thing with Tamiflu. It's really an amount that if there's a modest amount of virus, then you can get enough drug to the virus to stop it from replicating and keep the level low enough for the host to kind of knock off the rest of the virus and not develop all of these other problems that come about from the inflammation and the response of the host for the virus. And so if you can keep the virus low enough, you don't get that big of a response from the host, and it doesn't lead to all of these other complications that end up with, blood clots or breathing difficulties or the other problems that you're going to develop in the other organs. And so it's not going to be, it's not really going to be dependent upon where the virus is going, because you're not, you're just, it's a systemic treatment.
All right. We only have about, 12 minutes, and we've got a week to kind of wrap up if you want, Henry, whatever you want to do. We got a weekend coming up. We're on target, for 100,000 dead. All right. This month, mid-May. That's the way it looks now. Sometime in May.
And one of the arguments is that these curves generally are bell shaped, so that and the number of deaths is kind of at the peak. It hasn't really started going down, and so they're usually relatively symmetrical. So if you basically have 65,000 deaths going up, you're probably going to get something like 65,000 deaths coming down. And so, that's 130,000 right there. And, the 65,000 going up happened mostly during the social distancing. So, I mean, there were already measures that were put into effect to kind of flatten the curve and to keep that curve from going too high. And now, states are kind of loosening those things and looking to return to normal, so to speak. And, Trump wants to go out and do his rallies and blah, blah, blah. And there may be more deaths coming down, because it may not really be at the top yet, because loosening the regulations may cause the numbers to go up. And today's numbers that went up, some of the media reports are trying to say that it was from, loosening, and they got excited. Georgia was going up pretty dramatically. But a lot of this, there's going to be a little bit of a lag. So even if you look at number of new cases, it usually takes a little bit of time. And it hasn't even been a full week yet. Or I guess it is a full week since they first started it. So you might start to see it, but it's probably not going to show up, because A, you've got to get infected. B, you have to develop symptoms, because generally people don't go to the doctor when they're asymptomatic. So you've got to develop symptoms, and you got to be convinced that those symptoms are really COVID, and then you got to go see a doctor, and then they have to test you. So, any infections that kind of come from loosening of the regulations is probably going to have, a couple, 2 to 3 week lag. So the effects of that you might see towards the end of next week, or maybe even the middle of next week, but seeing it today is is probably a little bit early. Today's may just be the fact that Georgia has all of these institutions. They've got a lot of prisons there that have at least some positive, and so they may have started, you know, doing more testing there, or they have a lot of poultry processing plants, and they may have some outbreaks there, and exactly what's causing the numbers to jump there isn't clear. But, you know, as you saw from what I read off, it really wasn't limited to that. So, you know, the numbers are going up. It's not April. It's now May. The numbers, I mean, it kicks off May the first day with 35,000 new cases. So that's not an indication that looks like the heat or the sunlight or anything else is really causing a significant slowdown.
And, no. What's our best guess at a case fatality rate now in terms of resolved cases here in the U.S.? Do you have any numbers for us? What's it looking at?
Well, it's hard because sometimes people are discharged and they don't really say what their status is. But
right.
I think the number is in the of cases that have pneumonia, that it's in the probably 15% fatality rate of those cases, and so it's probably the same level or a little bit higher than SARS. It's definitely high enough to cause serious problems, and it's very age dependent. So those that are 65 and older probably it even keeps going up. It's like 25% if you're, I think, 75 or 80 or older, and it kind of slides down over that age range. So it's somewhat dependent upon the age, and that's the fatal part. There's younger ones that are having these heart attacks and strokes that they're young, and they sometimes are catching them early, so they aren't fatal, but they can still be debilitating.
Oh, very damaging.
One other thing I could touch on, because it's now getting more and more in the news, is the origin of the virus. And Trump had said in response to reporters, I think today, if it wasn't today, it was yesterday, that they wanted to know whether he was aware of any evidence that that the virus came from a lab in Wuhan. And he said yes. And they said, what are the specifics? He said, I can't tell you that. But my suspicion is that the only data he actually has is the fact that they're, one of the labs in Wuhan does research on SARS-like viruses and bats, and actually goes to the Yunnan province in southern China to collect samples and bring them back to Wuhan. And that lab had, prior to about a week ago, had the closest match to the SARS-CoV-2. It was a 2003 isolate, and it was like 96% identical, and that was the highest identity from a bat, and it was identified by a lab in Wuhan. Now, since then, about a week ago, another sequence came out, and that one was collected more recently. That was collected in 2019, actually, like in the middle of the year, around June or so. So it was, several months before the start of the outbreak. And that lab was in northern China, but they also collected bats southern China, also in Yunnan province, but the cave that they went to was right on the border with Cambodia, and it was a different species. They were both horseshoe bats, but in any event, the point is that that's about the only data that really links a lab to this virus, and it was, you know, 96%. Yeah, I mean, the difference between 96% and 99% is a lot when you look at it. And when you got 30,000 physicians to look at, there's a lot of differences there. So you wouldn't mistake those two. But I think that that's the extent of the data. The intelligence has come out and said that there's definitely not any evidence that it was manipulated and it would not be something that would be in a program. And I had mentioned this, that if even if it was in a vaccine program, they would have flown the virus out. And the number of different mutations that have showed up with this virus and the time that they showed up is an indication that the original virus wasn't a cloned version. It was more of a wild type, you know, something from the wild, and had, you know, a major sequence and a whole lot, bunch of minor sequences, and that's where you see these various recombinances show up in these various versions of the virus. And so the sequence itself and the various isolates would argue against it being something that was manipulated in the lab. But what the intelligence couldn't rule out, and I think is a difficult thing to rule out, is the possibility that there was a sample that was brought to a lab, and potentially the person that was handling the sample got infected, and so a person might have got infected in the lab and then gone and then passed the virus to other people in Wuhan, and that's how it got started. And that type would be hard to rule out, especially if it was, you know, in a sample that they hadn't even processed that much. So basically the lab doesn't even know it had that particular sequence present in the samples, and it happened to infect, you know, a technician or somebody even that was collecting the samples in Wuhan, you know, in a Yunnan province where the bat cave was. I mean, they might have been collecting samples and gotten infected in the cave and then went back to Wuhan where the lab was and infected people there.
There's one thing we can say for sure. It, wherever it came from, has done a hell of a lot of damage in a very short period of time, which is not going to be reversible anytime soon, if ever. It's been enormous. Yeah. I don't think anyone's adequately calculated it yet. Go ahead.
Well, no. That virus is here to stay. That's why everybody but Donald Trump says it'll be here in the fall. Whether it'll be back in the fall or whether it'll still be here in the fall is the only issue. But it will be in the fall. It will be around. It's just way too widespread. It's worldwide.
Oh, it's everywhere.
Yeah, you know, a couple hundred countries now, and this one version is kind of taking over. So it's adapting very well to humans, and so
it's very happy.
It's a serious problem, and this is one of the reasons why I've said before, and I'll say again, that something like a coronavirus is not something that anybody would think about making into a bioweapon, because you just can't control it. And once it gets out, it can mutate, it can change, and it can adapt even further. And this would be a good example of this. You know, however this got in the human population, once it got in, it was very hard to control. And even if you could control it temporarily, like, you know, with very strong measures in China, China is still battling, you know, new reoccurrences in China as well as imports from outside of China. So like you said, it's an ongoing problem that isn't going away anytime soon.
Nope.
And that's why, the first rule of a bioweapon is the ability to direct and control it. If you can't do those two things, it's not advantageous to anybody making it. So,
right.
Anyway, that's right. Where we are. So we're in a new month, and numbers are at an all-time high, and it's not going to go away in May either.
No.
We'll see what the numbers look like, but it's about 65,000 by next week. It'll cross 70,000 and well on its way to 80 by,
How much more can Donald Trump take before he falls apart?
I don't know. Well, we may find out.
Yeah, indeed. Henry, thank you. You have a good weekend. Take care.
Okay, you too. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Dr. Henry Nyman, and thanks to all of you for being here. We will be right back with you tomorrow, 2 days from tomorrow. Yeah, that's what it is. 2 day weekend. Whew. Have fun, take care, and you know where you can find us at rents.com. We'll talk soon.